I'm sorry?
Do you have your envelope?
Oh.
Theoretically, yes.
How's that literally?
And actually, I do.
Thank you very much.
Sure.
Okay.
We'll start with our blessing.
Baruch atah Adonai Eloheinu melech haolam asher bachar banu mikol hamim v'na'atan lanu et torato. Baruch atah Adonai notein haTorah.
This week was a very special week. It was the Purim Katan and Purim and Shushan Purim Katan, which are the kind of the pre-echoes of Purim that are coming in a month from now. So on the 14th and the 15th of Adar 1, we had Purim Katan, which is Little Purim, and it's Purim for all intents and purposes, except there's no Megillah reading, there's no Shalach Manos, there's no Matanot Levyonim, which are gifts to the poor, and other than that, it's Purim. So I hope you had a really nice Purim. And yesterday was Purim Shushan Purim Katan, which was in Jerusalem and in the walled cities that Purim was celebrated for an extra day and will be in a month from now. But all of this is Purim, and this is the most powerful aspect of Purim that we had was really the power of prayer. So the power of prayer on Purim was the power to turn things around, to make something, decrees go in a different direction. And the decree of Haman against the Jewish people, Ahasuerus against the Jewish people, was turned over and we were saved. And so really the entire month of Adar is about that. So the entire month of Adar is considered very auspicious for prayer. So even though if you might have missed Purim Katan and Shushan Purim Katan, that we still have the month of Adar. In fact, we're very fortunate this year to have two Adars, so we get a double portion of that, plus the double portion of Simcha, the double portion of happiness, Misha Nichnas Adar, Marbim B'Simcha, that when Adar comes in, Simcha is increased, and we have the greater ability to feel Simcha, to access Simcha, as well as the obligation to be B'Simcha. So that's what we have for 60 days, which is a great double dose. You'll excuse me a second.
Mm-hmm. So is the Purim Katan because we have two Adars?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, okay. So it only happens every...
So anytime there is a leap year, which in the Jewish calendar is not on like every 4 years, it's seven times within a 19-period cycle. That's the total cycle is 19 years. Seven times within that, there'll be a leap year. There may be even occasions where it goes leap year, not a leap year, no, 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 leap year. So it's one of those kind of things. And as we know, the whole purpose of having a leap year, the extra month, is to make sure that Pesach stays in the spring. Otherwise, with the lunar calendar, Pesach would be like Ramadan, and would gradually move around the calendar and end up in some other season. And Pesach must be in the springtime for the land of Israel. So the extra month is that. So the extra month is the first one. The second Adar is the real one. So that's a little confusing, because usually we think if something's going to be extra, it's added onto the end, like the 29th day of February. We don't say the 28th day is the extra day and the 29th day is the regular day. It's like, that makes no sense. So, of course, that's how we do it. Makes no sense. So we have the extra first, but that's primarily because Purim and Pesach, the actual celebration of the full Purim and Pesach, need to be 4 weeks apart. It needs to be 4 weeks apart. So if we had the real Purim with Megillah and everything else this week, then it would be 8 weeks between now and Pesach. 8 weeks is already feeling too short.
Exactly.
I was like,
So what happened?
It's 4 weeks is because it needs to be, it's really the cycle of redemptions, of redemption that comes from when God is, where there's clearly a saving, but God's presence is hidden, to moving into God's presence is revealed. Normally, if it's not a leap year, we have three holidays of redemption, starting with Tu B'Shvat. So it says really Tu B'Shvat, Purim, Pesach. Tu B'Shvat, where what's going on inside the trees is completely hidden from view. It doesn't look like anything's happening, and we can't see anything happening, but something is happening. Purim, where we see something's happening, but we don't see the cause. because it looks political, it looks like court espionage, it looks like court intrigue or whatever. And then we have Pesach, where it is clearly revealed and everybody sees what it is and knows who's behind it. So those three provide, basically on the full moons of each of their months, on the 15th of Shvat, the full moon of Shvat, the 14th, 15th of Adar, Purim, and then the 14th, 15th of Nisan, Pesach. So those three provide like a benchmark of redemption, of ever increasing. So it's only when there's Adar 1, which is why we have to have something, because you can't have the beginning of redemption, blank, something. So it moves a little bit from like a 1.5 redemption. So we have Tu B'Shvat, then we have Purim Katan, where we have a little bit of Purim, and then next month, full Purim, and then Pesach. But it has to go up in that. It has to increase. It can't go from here to here, down, and then up. It needs to show that there is an order, there's a Seder, and there's a progression, which is supposed to be a comfort to us, that depending on where we are in our own personal lives or in the lives of the Jewish peoples, like, are we at a Tu B'Shvat time? Are we at an Adar time? Are we at a Pesach time? Because it's going to be one of those. Either something's going on behind the scenes and we just can't see it. It looks like winter. It looks like nothing's happening, but it is. Or we're seeing something, but it doesn't look like it's being caused by divine intervention. Or we should be so lucky to see, like, well, actually we see it and we know exactly where it's coming from. So that's the season that we are in here, which is really beautiful to think about. So that was Purim. And now on, and it also gives us this double Adar of this double month of happiness. Ilana, would you mind just catching the door behind you?
Did anything happen these last couple of days?
Mm-hmm. Yes. So the things that happened. So thank you. So God forbid, if there would have been a funeral on Tuesday or Wednesday, the prayer El Male Rachamim, El Male Rachamim, da na 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 na, would not have been recited. Because that is not recited when there's a holiday. And so Yom Kippur. It is like Yom Kippur. Purim, and Purim Katan are little miniature holidays. Same thing was true if you went to services, which I did not, on those mornings. A prayer that would normally be said in the davenings called Tachanun is not recited, as it is not recited on other holidays. So anything that has something that is excluded because it's a holiday is excluded for Purim Katan and Shushan Purim Katan. And some people did make an effort to give extra tzedakah on that day, to pray. As I said, that was the main thing, is davening. And some people make a little feast, and they have like a little seuda. And they say, like, this is a prequel to the holiday. So it's a little echo. Also, yortzeits that fall. So, for example, if somebody's yortzeit, like my grandmother's yortzeit, for example, is the same as Moshe Rabbeinu's, same as Moses's, and was on the 7th of Adar. But it's the 7th of Adar, but when there are two Adars, it's like, well, if it's in the second Adar, then for sure you do it in the second Adar. If it's the first Adar, then you do it in the first Adar. But when there's two Adars, so many people do something twice. So on the 7th of Adar this month was an echo of Moshe's yortzeit. And so there were things that people did in honor of that. So one of the things that's done, actually I think they save it for the second one, is Chevre Kadishas. The burial societies often have their events, their fundraising event, on Moshe's yortzeit.
They did.
Did they have it this pet? Did they already have it?
Yeah, they already had it.
Okay, so they had it for in
last week or two.
There you go. So they had it in the first Adar, even though it was yortzeit, it's not really, would be officially observed in the second.
Why Moshe's yortzeit?
Moshe's yortzeit, I think because it talks about Hashem buried him, and that just like the idea of burial, that he, the way he died, and Hashem kissed him and took out his soul in that way, and so it's Moshe's.
Okay.
So, yeah, good question.
He
did not have a funeral that was attended by anyone other than Hashem. So the people mourned for him afterwards, but nobody was present at his burial.
So we don't know
exactly where it is, because God did not want it to turn into a site to be worshipped. and which is really funny. I mean, because we know where other people are buried, and we've gone to other, the Rabbi Akiva, we've gone to other people's, right? We went there in Tveria. So we know a lot of those, but when the higher somebody is, the with Moshe Rabbeinu, it was very important that people not know, so that it not turn into
a shrine,
exactly, that it turned be deified. That it not be deified, so it was not. So we just know that it was, we know it was Har Nebo, which is why the BMH cemetery is called Mount Nebo. That's Har Nebo, that's the name of where Moshe was buried. So Har Nebo, Mount Nebo is a common name for a cemetery because that's where Moshe was buried.
So do we know where Har Nebo is?
Approximately, but people don't go there. It's like we don't go there. It's like,
isn't that in Jordan?
Probably. Yeah, well, for sure it's not in Israel, because as you remember, he didn't get to come into the land of Israel, so it's not on...
It's still not the land of Israel.
Still not in the land of Israel. And we don't go. It's like, if you want to access Moshe Rabbeinu, turn to page, you know. This is where we Moshe's coming.
Beyond Jordan.
I believe so. My knowledge of geography...
When we left Egypt...
I'm sorry? Yes, that Jordan. He's on the other side. If you remember that God tells him to climb to the top of the mountain to look out over the land, and he saw the entire land, and then he said, now it's time for you to pass away. And interesting, this is very interesting, just as an aside, saw for the first time fascinating midrash that said that Moshe fought, did not want to die. That it wasn't, yeah, I'm 120, been there, done that, you know, I'm tired, can't go out anymore. That he was like, his eyes, it says, were still clear. He still had strength. There was no reason for him to die. And so he goes, and the Midrash recounts a dialogue between him and God, saying, but I have so much left to do. Like, I'm the leader of the Jewish people. I don't want to die. And saying, it's time. And he's going on and on and on. And then finally he says, go up, lie down, close your eyes, put your feet together, put your hands on your chest. He says, and then Hashem kissed him. He said, and I will take your soul to the most, to the highest level, closeness to my throne. And that with that, then he did. And then God kissed him, and his neshama went
his
right
spirit.
Out. His neshama went right out of.
That's his spirit.
Right, yes.
Soul.
Well, you call it his soul. His soul. He took his neshama out from him, and then he passed away, and that went on. But it was a good, I had never seen this before, and I knew that he had wanted to go into the land of Israel, but it just seems kind of funny arguing with God, like, I don't want to die, I don't want to die, because you think, like, he would have equanimity. It's like, oh, yes, I'm dying. He's like, no, I want to stay, I want to stay. But that tells us that's a Jewish attitude, which is, there's more I can do. You know, he wasn't sick, he was not unwell, he had strength, but it was like, so he wanted to keep going, and Hashem said, no, your mission is done. Your mission is done. And so even if you are well and you've done your prime, it's like, no, you're done.
So when we die, there's a delay until our soul doesn't go up until we're buried?
Oh, so the soul has a kind of a gradual process of disengagement. So for sure the soul is out of the body.
Right.
As soon as you die, your soul is out of your body, but it is hovering.
For how long?
It hovers in varying levels of concentration, if you could say that. Mm-hmm. So that's one of the reasons why there's a shomer, why there's a guard at before mm-hmm. burial, is to comfort the neshama. Mm-hmm. The neshama who is in the presence of its partner, and they're separating. It's just like the partnership is breaking up. And so there is a grief on the part of the neshama. So from then until burial, and then the neshama has comfort that its body has been taken care of, and then it's in concentrated, like during the 7 days of Shiva, the first 30 days, and then till the Yort site. But then there's another time where it gains additional comfort and can go up, elevate more, which is when the headstone is placed. So it's once the headstone is placed, that the neshama also has comfort's like, okay, I know where my body is, and because there's the partnership between them is forever, and the neshama maintains contact with that body.
So it sounds like for Moshe, that process was speeded up.
Yes. So for Moshe, it went... So his, that's a very good point. His was almost like how we understand for a God forbid, a newborn baby. So one of the reasons we don't have a funeral or sit Shiva for a baby under 30 days old is because it's like Moshe. The neshama goes back immediately to Hashem, and there is no hovering. There is no anything because it hasn't fused. It's kind of like the, I don't know, the part in your, the soft spot on the skull for a baby. It takes a while to fuse. It says the neshama takes 30 days to fuse to the body. So that when a baby dies before 30 days, we don't do the things that would be for the comfort of the neshama.
It's so comforting to the family.
So you are still then supposed to visit. You don't ignore it. I mean, the family is still visited, and but you don't say Kaddish. It's not. You don't say this. You don't sit Shiva. You mourn, but you don't sit. You don't have official Shiva. Now this is interesting. Very, very sadly, a rabbinic decision was made contrary to that. Very sadly, in Israel, just a couple months ago, the woman who was shot at in the drive-by shooting, the terrorist, and then her baby died after it was born, after just a few days. So normally there would not have been a funeral and there would be no Shiva. But the rabbis, the chief head rabbis in Israel, said, this is different. Because during those 4 days or 3 days while that baby was still alive, the impact that that baby's life had on the entire Jewish world, people made commitments to take on mitzvot. Women lit their Shabbos candles early. They added to Shabbos. They stopped speaking Lashon Hara. It says what that baby's life triggered in that short time was as if, and the unity that it brought to Jewish people, everyone davening for that baby's well-being, what that baby accomplished in 4 days was as if its soul was completely connected and it had a lifetime. And so the rabbi said, yes, a funeral, and yes, Shiva. Which I didn't even think of that when, you know, they were interviewing the mother, you know, during Shiva, what her perspective was. I didn't even think, like, well, why was there even a Shiva? Right. But that's why there was.
It's just in this case.
This case.
So
this.
Why sadly?
Sadly, the baby died. Yeah, sadly because the baby died.
She was shocked.
It would have been, right, it would have been obviously better had he lived, but even that the name that they gave was all about the Jewish people are eternal. So it was like as if he became a symbol. So anytime there's something that symbolizes the totality of the Jewish people, it gets treated differently. That's why the king of the Jewish people gets treated differently. It's not that the king is above the law. He is not. In fact, he has to carry a Torah scroll with him at all times to remind himself that he's not above the law. That being said, it says, but the honor due to the king is the collective honor of the Jewish people all emplaced on that one person. So that's why there are some things that, there's a whole Hilchos Malachim, the whole laws of kings, which I've never had any reason to read about, but there's a whole thing about the laws of the kings, and they are treated different when it comes to honor, because they carry the honor of the Jewish people. It's one of the reasons why King Saul, when he was in battle and he was going to be captured by the Philistines. Thank you, Vera.
When was that?
That's okay.
They're very cute, but it's makes
distracting.
Us, it's distracting. Thank you, Vera. That he chose to fall on his sword rather than to be captured by the Philistines. Now, usually we don't have killing yourself as an option. But what the Philistines would have done to him, you know, King Saul, what they would have done to him, as we can only imagine, would have been to behead him, or not after dragging his body like behind a horse and the humiliation of the kingship. So it wasn't like, oh, I'm scared to be killed by the Philistines. It was like the kingship of the Jewish people rested in him, the honor of the Jewish people, and so he fell on his sword.
What about our Israeli soldiers, past and present, who have been captured by our enemies?
Well, they are not supposed to kill themselves.
They're still not supposed to.
No, absolutely not. They might be rescued. They might be rescued. It doesn't. We never give up.
We never give up.
Right. Right. No, we don't ever give up on that. And no, to kill yourself prematurely is definitely not the right thing to do.
Okay.
For King Saul was in battle, and his death was imminent, and it was a matter of him being captured. What that would have done, that's a soldier, I'm sorry to say, is not the same as the collective honor of the entire people. It's just not the same. I mean,
our officers aren't the same. They're treated differently.
It doesn't matter. No,
they're
right.
Supposed to be.
It doesn't matter. The king has a different status than any other individual person, no matter how amazing they are.
Okay.
So, all right, all that's about death and Moshe and the things that we learn. So, this week we are in Parsha Ki Tisa, which is on page 485. And we have to make note, especially after last week when we spoke about the creation of the incense altar, which was in a separate section from all of the other furnishings of the Mishkan. We had the ark, the menorah, the shulchan, the table, all of the planks, all of the structural things, everything structural for the Mishkan we had in Parsha Truma. In Parsha, the next week's Parsha, which was last week's Parsha of Tetzaveh, we had the clothing of the Kohanim. And then after the Kohanim, if you remember, the Kohanim's clothing after that was all described. Then we had what looked like a PS of the creation of the incense altar. And we talked about how that was not an afterthought, that in fact it represented the whole point of our connection with Hashem in the Mishkan, which was to be connected. And the incense altar, which had incense and smell, has to do with the neshama. Because neshama and neshima of breathing, of inhaling, the word is neshima. One of the phrases that means that somebody has a soul is nishma be'apo. There is a neshama in his nose. Okay, that means that you've been endowed with a soul. That's the phrase that is... and it's in the prayer for Israel. I just saw it last Shabbos after our class. You know, when you see a word and then it just kind of grabs you? So in the prayer for Israel, when it refers to everybody who has a soul, the Hebrew is kol asher nishmat be'apo, everyone who has a neshama in his nose. It's like, okay, that's interesting. And as we know, that's why we say bless you and gesundheit when someone sneezes. You know, that because the understanding would be that the soul went in through the nose and it can come out. And if you sneeze, that would be how people used to die, is they would sneeze and their soul went out. So that's why I say gesundheit.
So it goes in our soul when we're born or when we're conceived?
I don't know. This is how when God created Adam and Eve, it says that he blew in nishmat kol chai. He blew in the breath of life through his nose. So through his nose, so that's considered the entry point and the exit point. So to say that someone has a soul, so the phrase happens to be nishma be'apo. He has a neshama in his nose. That's why maybe Jewish people have bigger noses. We've got like more neshama than I to go in there. So you know, it's a good thing we got to have that. Okay. So we had that, and with the incense, and that the smelling of that would bring people kind of back, literally to their senses, would bring them back to their neshama connection, and that the sense of smell is the only one that bypasses any kind of cognitive thought. You don't think about smells; it goes directly to the part of your brain, which Ita Liban told us on Shabbos. I forgot all the scientific names. Everything, it goes straight to your brain, and is. Like that, an instantaneous process. It is not like sight. It is not like hearing. It is not processed in your mind. So this was like a way to get back to where you're supposed to be, would be to smell the incense, which was the whole point. So that's all well and good until we have this week's Parsha. And this week's Parsha, we have yet one more thing that was created. One more thing, and that's on page 487, and that is the laver. That is the laver, which of course has direct connection to the Jewish women. And Mindy, would you like to read that? Page 487, chapters 17 through 21.
Hashem spoke to Moses, saying, "You shall make a copper laver and its base of copper for washing it. Place it between the tent of meeting and the altar and put water there. From it, Aaron and his sons shall wash their hands together with their feet. Whenever they come to the tent of meeting, they shall wash with water and not die. Or when they approach the altar to serve, to raise up in a smoke fire offering to Hashem, they shall wash their hands and feet and not die. It shall be for them an eternal decree, for him and his offspring, for their generations."
Okay, great. This laver, as we know, was made from what? The copper mirrors of the women that they brought, and they donated all of them. Moshe wasn't quite sure what to do with them. They seemed to be something that was an article for
vanity,
exactly, stimulating lust or whatever. And he was like, no, that this is holy, and not only take some of them, but take every single one of them. The laver is the only article in the Mishkan that does not have a measurement given. Because if you take all of the mirrors, because we know that some of the things that were collected, it was like too much. It's like, because the Torah outlines exactly what the dimensions are supposed to be of every single thing. The only thing that does not give any dimensions is the laver. Because it was like, whatever the women donate, that's, so it was the materials that defined the structure, as opposed to the structure defining the dimensions used. If you like baking, it's like, well, I'm going to bake some, I have 5 pounds of flour, so that's what I'm using. It's like, recipes don't really work like that. You say, this recipe requires 6 cups of flour. It's like, well, but I have 10. You can't say, well, then just put it in. It's like, no, this was put it in. Whatever the women are contributing, that was going to be it. But we have to understand what it means to have the Kohanim wash in it, because this then becomes a prerequisite. Never mind the incense, never mind the ark, never mind the menorah, never mind any of it. What is the attitude that is coming in? What is the attitude that is coming in to the service of the Mishkan? What is it that the Kohanim are needing to do? They need to immerse in what the women had naturally. They had to go through a process by washing their hands and their feet in the water that was being held by the emunah, the faith and trust that the women had in Egypt. It's like, this was the ongoing, everything that the women represented. People say, oh, the women aren't there. It's like, are you kidding me? The Kohanim had to wash themselves and immerse in that before they could officiate with anything. It's like, if they're not even coming in with the right attitude, the right approach, and they're kind of like they're not lined up yet, they can't even officiate. And it wasn't like, well, if they don't, no problem. Because what does it say twice? They better do it or they die. Okay? You can't, it's not possible. You cannot be a Kohen. You cannot do all of this unless you have the emunah, the faith and trust. And not just the faith and trust in your mind, in your heart, but in the parts of the body that symbolize doing something. Your hands and your feet. Your hands and your feet, the things, the way we act in this world, the way we go in this world, needs to be an expression of emunah, which is what the Jewish women were and continue to be down to today, is we are the ones. And that's what the Kohanim had to wash in before they did anything. This is just fascinating. Janice.
So you said they took all of the mirrors.
All the mirrors the women donated.
Oh, that the women donated.
Yes.
Oh, okay. It wasn't like, you must give me every mirror.
Oh, no, no,
okay.
No.
Okay.
Oh, absolutely not. Oh, absolutely. The opposite. The opposite. The women said, we want to give our mirrors. And Moshe was like, mirrors? That's like, you know, that's like Victoria's Secret. Like, what are you giving me that for? What does that have to do with the Mishkan?
Okay.
And Hashem says to Moshe, every single one of them, all the mirrors, and the women are called the legions. The legions who used to mass at Moshe's tent to learn Torah. People always wonder, how come more women than men show up for Torah classes? It's like, because they always have. I remember asking that to Rabbi Twersky, you know, when I studied with him. Where are the men? He says, where have they always been? You know, it's there, whatever. The women are coming first. The women are, give me Torah. I want to learn. It says, the legions of women massed at Moshe's tent to learn Torah. They went, we want to give our mirrors. He's like, I'm not so sure. Hashem says, you take them. Not only take them, because he could have said, yeah, we'll take them, and I know, we'll make a door for the coat closet or something out of it. Like, you know, it could have been some side thing. It's like, no. What's going to be made out of that is the laver, which is going to be where the Kohanim wash before they even start doing anything. Before they start doing anything. It's such a profound message. We don't tend to think about this for ourselves, of who we are, the history that we represent, the connection that we represent. And we also know that water, because it could have been, maybe they would just make a very big mirror out of it. You know, just make a big mirror, and all the Kohanim would have to look in the mirror like the women, and then they would go and officiate. But it was to hold water. And water is the symbol of emunah. It's like being in a state of flow and being present to whatever is happening. It's like, we'll talk to you, I'm in the flow. Like, I'm like totally paying attention. Water, that's the nature of water. Says, you wash in that. You immerse yourself in that, and that's how you prepare yourself for holiness. It says, in other words, immerse yourself in Jewish womanhood and everything it represents, and then maybe you have half a chance of officiating for the rest of everything else and getting someplace. So that's the nature, is the Kohanim are immersing in Jewish womanhood in order to be able to officiate.
So the Jewish women had the mirrors in Egypt so that they could do what they could do to make themselves attractive so that their husbands would be with them to get pregnant.
Exactly.
Because
that's right.
The Pharaoh was killing right. the babies.
Right. That's, so they were using that to encourage their husbands to continue having babies, which was an act of emunah, because why would you continue having babies if there's a decree of death against them? That's irrational. That would be like, oh, that's a woman being irrational. You know, what are you doing? That's so irrational. It's like, that's called super rational. That's called aligning your mind with God, which is what Miriam said to her father. You're worse than Pharaoh. You're decreeing that the men should separate. Go. You need to go back. Pharaoh is a person. His lifetime is limited. We need to focus on what Hashem wants from us. So there was another question, comment or something?
Yeah.
Why don't we go ahead?
Okay.
Okay. All right. So
God
in Keith.
God made women perfect and men aren't.
When no.
You said spirituality.
No. Nobody is perfect.
Perfect.
Perfection.
You don't have to have a circumcision.
Okay. Okay. That's true.
Do
okay. Okay, Marcia. I'm going to continue if that's okay.
Okay.
Okay. Women do not need to have a circumcision. It says that we are already circumcised. Circumcision is to remove barriers to connection. That's what it means to circumcise your heart, circumcise your lips, circumcise for a man. It means to remove a barrier. So removing a barrier says women don't have that barrier. It doesn't mean that we're perfect. Just look around. We are not perfect. We are just more connected. We don't have the barriers. Though I have to say that we are living in a world where women are so connected to the male energy that they've kind of created more barriers than are supposed to be there. But we are connected, and that's why we don't have a circumcision. We're born with it. We are born in that state. Tova, and then we're going to go ahead.
I was just going to ask you, you just answered it, that there's different levels of connection for women, but not naturally. It happens because we're exposed to male energy.
So our goal is to protect our connection. The male goal is to get the connect, is to remove the barriers. Ours is to protect it. So if you have something, then you protect it from being messed up. If you don't have it yet because there's a barrier even to getting it, when Rabbi Yitzchak Feldheim came and spoke at a wonderful retreat for the Jewish experience, his metaphor he used is, women are born at the top of the mountain. Their goal is to not fall off or climb down. The men are born at the bottom, and their goal is to climb the ladder and come up. The role of the woman is to encourage the man to come up and hold the ladder firmly.
It's a male dog.
Sorry. to hold it firmly so that he can climb. It is not to say, hey, it looks really good down there on the ground. I think I'll climb down and get in the pit with him. The goal is to stay on top. So staying on top means protection, which is why women have more fences around what keeps them connected. So the laws of tznius, of dress, of protecting spirituality as opposed to physicality, the halachas about protecting in the form of the three mitzvahs of women, of mikvah, protecting the intimacy, of the challah, of protecting physicality of the physical world, and protecting time and the sacredness of the home through Shabbos candles. Ours are all about maintaining what we have. The men's is all about removing the barriers that are keeping them from getting there. Together, we're supposed to all end up on the top of the mountain. And we applaud, that's me, and we applaud the,
getting all of these
Okay, so that's the role of the women. So this was the Kohanim were called the wives of the temple. So because their primary jobs was to cook and clean. You know, they were inside. The wives, they were the wives of the temple. Their jobs were to create the environment, the house. That's why it's called a Beit HaMikdash. It's a house of holiness. It's modeled after Sarah's tent. Sarah is the main Beit HaMikdash. The Beit HaMikdash and the Mishkan are just bigger versions of the same thing. They were all places for their, where there was going to be connection. Connection between people and people and people and Hashem. That's the purpose of a house. That's the purpose of a home. That's the purpose of the Beit HaMikdash. So that's what we have in Parsha Ki Tisa. So we were doing really well until we had the golden calf. Other than that, things were going great. So we want to take a look at the golden calf incident here. But we're going to talk about...
I'm sorry, I have a question about the timing. So wasn't the golden calf earlier than when they started building the...
The Mishkan? So the very good question. There's actually a debate about which came first, the golden calf, and whether the Mishkan was a kapara, an atonement for the golden calf, or whether the Mishkan was planned all along and then the golden calf also happened. So most say that the golden calf happened first and then the Mishkan as an atonement for it, because since the people gave their gold to build the golden calf, the atonement is to give their stuff to build something that is holy and to be involved in that. That's another whole bigger discussion, but you're absolutely right to raise that as a question. So
my other question is, I just think of my fun. I'm saying it because it's funny to me. So because we're at the top of the mountain, we get to cook and clean?
Cooking and cleaning is what we do to create. Listen, the other people are climbing in the mud. Which would you rather do? Okay. I'm sorry?
Finish that sentence.
To create an environment. Creating a holy environment. It's like when you're making a party, guess what you got to do? You go shopping and you set things up and you buy things. It's all using the physical world to create spiritual space. That's the role of the woman, using the physical world to create spiritual space. That's the definition of a home. It's a physical thing that allows spiritual things to happen. You can't do it without it. The man refers to his wife as his home. A man who divorces his wife is called homeless. A man who divorces his wife is called homeless. She is never homeless because she is the home. And just think about what it takes to take care of yourself. You have to feed yourself, you clean yourself, you pick up after yourself. Everyone thinks it's like all these other lofty tasks to do. There aren't. Either we're doing it for ourselves or we're doing it for someone else. That's like the bulk of our day. It's like we're either preparing for one thing or cleaning up after what we just did. That's what we're doing. So that's the woman's role. That's not the only thing she does, but she has to create that space. Okay, the golden calf and God's anger. Now, page 400, what was that?
Can she hire it out?
Yes, she can. She can hire out, yes, she can, absolutely. If her time is better spent doing something else, then absolutely she should hire it out. Absolutely she should hire it out.
Oh, that's great.
I haven't had the privilege, but I would love to do that. Okay. Let's look at God's anger for the golden calf on page 495. I'm assuming people know Moshe went up to Mount Sinai. He was there. He was gone for 40 days. The people got distracted. They got whatever that was. We're going to just go right into God's response to it. So we're going on page 495, and they're in the process of worshiping the golden calf. On verse 7, Hashem is going to speak to Moshe. Janice, do you want to read verses 7 and 8, please?
Sure. Hashem spoke to Moses, "Go, descend, for your people that you brought up from Egypt has become corrupt. They have strayed quickly from the way that I have commanded them."
Okay. So two things here. It's kind of funny. This reminds me of parents who, when one child is acting badly, the parent says, "Your child," yeah. So Hashem spoke to Moses, "Go descend, for your people that you brought up out of Egypt." It's like, since when is that? It's like, so God is doing like, okay, this is a problem. He's distancing himself from any relationship. This is your people who you brought up. And now he's going to use a word that is going to be a challenge. This word came learned from Rabbi David Foreman. In the Hebrew, it says, "Ki shichet." Amcha. The word shichet, to become corrupt. Keep your string right here and just turn back for a moment to Genesis chapter 6, verse 12. Genesis chapter 6, verse 12 is going to take us right back into the before the flood. Page 31. Verse 11. Page 31, verse 11. Let's read that. Vera, would you read that, please?
Now the earth had become corrupt before God, and the earth had become filled with robbery.
Okay, and then it's going to repeat that, and the word in the Hebrew is vatishachet. So the root is shin, chet, tav, and it means to become corrupt. So now Moshe is hearing these words from Hashem. Your people have become corrupt. Using that word, if you're Moshe, what are you thinking? It's like he already just said, your people who you brought out of Egypt has become corrupt. It's like, that's not good. The next thing that's going to come here is a potential destruction. It's going to be a destruction. And he says, they have strayed quickly from the way that I have commanded them. They didn't even go to wait too long. Yes.
Isn't it the fact that Hashem says your people, it does not make sense because Hashem did not want him to bring out certain elements and Moshe asked him to.
That is another line of commentary. It has to do with the Erev Rav, yeah. When it says your people. In this case, from this understanding, he's talking about everybody.
Everybody, okay.
Your people, because what he's going to say is the same thing, and you'll be able to tell from the next words. On page 497, they've made themselves... Now, notice Moshe doesn't say anything. He doesn't say, oh, I'm so, so sorry. I apologize. Well, he can't say, I'm so, so sorry. I apologize, because they're still in the process of doing it. You can't apologize and do teshuva for something you haven't stopped doing. I'm sorry that I'm, robbing the bank as I'm robbing. It's like, you haven't stopped. There's nothing to say while someone is in the middle of committing the sin. And he says, they've made themselves a molten calf, prostrated themselves to it, and sacrificed to it. And they said, this is your God, O Israel, which brought you up from the land of Egypt. Hashem said to Moses, I've seen this people, and behold, it's a stiff-necked people. And Moshe doesn't say anything. You notice Moshe hasn't said anything to any of these comments yet. When Rabbi Foreman discusses it, he says, we see these as consecutive sentences, because it's going, that's what it is. But we have to picture that it wasn't just Hashem having a tirade, that he was saying something and Moshe was not responding, not saying anything, because there's nothing really to say. That's why he's not saying anything. Then Hashem says, and now when he says, desist from me, and that phrase there is going to become important. And he says, v'ata hanichali, which means leave me alone. So it's on page 497. Now desist from me. Let my anger flare up against them, and I shall annihilate them, and I shall make you a great nation. So that's why, Vera, in this one, we're looking at if he's going to annihilate everyone, not just the Erev Rav, and I will make you a great nation, meaning Moshe. When he says that, desist from me, it really means leave me alone. Leave me alone, and I'm going to destroy them. This is the opening that Moshe has in a very strange way. If someone says, leave me alone and I'll destroy them, what are you not going to do?
Leave him alone.
I'm staying right here, because as soon as I say, okay, bye, if I go down and start in with the people, then I'm leaving you alone, Hashem, and you're going to destroy them. By the time I get down there, they're going to be toast. So I have to actually stay right there. My only hope as Moshe is to stay right there, and then Moshe says something to Hashem. And he says, he pleaded before Hashem, his God. That's such a weird kind of parenthetical statement. Who else, what other God would he be talking to? And said, now, if you're going to, don't look ahead. If you're going to say something to God about to help the Jewish people, what are you going to say? Not this. He's going to say, why, Hashem, should your anger flare up against your people? Like, why are you getting so bent out of shape? Like, why are you so angry? It's like, you call that, if someone says that to you when you're already upset, it says, what are you getting so upset about? I don't know about you. My response to that is to get more upset. Okay? So what's very interesting is in Hebrew, there are two words for why. One is madua, and has to do with the word mada, and Dea. Like, what's the reason, the understanding? Like, how did it happen? How did it come to be? Madua asi, like, why did you do that? Meaning, like, how did it come to be? The other has to do more with the past. But there's another word, which is lama, which is future-oriented, which means to what end? Lama, to what purpose? For what purpose? That's what he is asking. So if you go into the Hebrew, when Moshe is talking to him, go down to the 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, the sixth line in the Hebrew, the third word from the right. And then he says, Vayomer. Lama. Now, it's not lama, which is how you normally say lama. If you're in Israel, you want to know, like why, say lama. It's like lama. Do you see where the accent is? If someone is, when someone is laning the Torah and they read this, if they read this incorrectly, it will be corrected because it means something different.
The vowels are the same,
but the accent is different, and it changes what it means. Lama means to what end, and it emphasizes. Normally, even lama means to what end, like why, for what purpose, but to accent it like that, lama, because that's what it is, that's what the trup is, lama, to what end are you getting angry?
Oh, that's what that little sign next to the second vowel is.
Yes, that's a trup notation. So that would be sung, Lama Hashem. It wouldn't be if someone sings it, Lama Hashem, they will be corrected. Lama Hashem, to what purpose, God, are you getting angry? What are you going to do? You think this is not going to work out. That's the only argument he has, and it's the best argument there is. It's Moshe's chutzpah, and it's...
What I keep thinking of is it Abraham who argues with God about the 10 righteous and
yes.
You know, when he wants to destroy. And he has an argument there about, well, what about, you know, if there are 10 righteous.
Right, he argues for that. This
he
argument.
Do that here.
But he's going to present a different argument, which is, you know, you took the Jewish people. Why should your anger flare? To what end is your anger going to flare up? The people you've taken out of Egypt with great power and a strong hand. You remember that whole the display of your power that you demonstrated to the Egyptians? And now, if you destroy them, what are the Egyptians going to say? They're going to conclude bad things about you, Hashem. They're going to think, well, he didn't even have the power to take his people out and get them to the land he wanted them to get to. That's not so good. And then, why should Egypt, in fact, he puts words in Egypt's mouth. Why should Egypt say the following? With evil intent did he take them out to kill them in the mountains and to annihilate them from the face of the earth. You know why God took them out? He wanted to get rid of them just as much as we wanted to. It's like, oh, great, God's an anti-Semite. Okay, so then he's like, this is like, and then, relent from your flaring anger and reconsider the evil against your people. And by the way, remember you made a promise to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob? They're not going to be so happy with you either. You promised Abraham you have a covenant, the Brit HaBetarim. You have a covenant with Abraham that they are going to be oppressed, that you're going to take them out with great wealth, and that you will bring them back to the land. The only argument that Moshe has against God is God himself. It can't be on the merits of the Jewish people. They don't have them. It can't be that they're done sinning. They're not done sinning. It can't be anything other than this is not going to serve your purpose.
So it's like lama seems to mean, think about the unintended consequences.
Right, exactly. To what end? To what end? What's this going to get you? What's this going to get you? It's going to get you bad PR, all that effort you went to in Egypt with all the plagues and everything to demonstrate, I am God, I have the ultimate power. And now look, and I love, these are my firstborn, let them come and pray to me, and now you're going to kill them? It's like, it doesn't look good for you, God. You can't do it. And that's basically what Moshe says. And then what does, and he says, remember for the sake of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, your servants, to whom you swore by yourself, by your name. You told them, and he gives God's promise back to him, I shall increase your offspring like the stars of the heaven. Well, hello, if you destroy everybody and start over with me and my two sons, that's not the stars of the heaven. He gives it all back to him, and that's the only argument there is.
But this is God. Why doesn't God already know this?
God does know it. It's Moshe's opportunity. It's Moshe's opportunity to be Moshe. Of course God knows this. God didn't say, oh yeah, you know, I never thought about that. But, you know, now that you mention it, that really would be good.
But it's such a different argument than the other arguments we see in the Torah. you know, when Abraham or Moshe, you know, has in the past talked with God and argued. But this is a very different concept.
This is a very different argument, and it has to do with the situation as it is, because Moshe has himself right now has not yet seen the dancing. This is all going on while the dancing and is also happening. Mm. When he comes back up to ask for forgiveness for the Jewish people, then he's going to say, forgive them, they have sinned, they're sorry. But you can't, there's nothing to say right now. The only thing to hold off God is, you promised. But now tell, you're right. God knows this, so that means the learning is for us. What do we know this about this is, no matter what, God has to keep his promise of the good that he promised our ancestors, because he swore by his own name. It's not optional. So what are the chances that God's will be done and the Jewish people are going to achieve their ultimate purpose and destiny in this world? What percentage likelihood is it?
100%.
100%. Not happening any other way. It can be messy along the way, and there can be a lot of grief along the way. But they're going to get there because God promised. And Moshe takes this opportunity to say, see, even when it looks horrible, like he should be dumping them, it's not going to happen. Not because we're deserving, but because God promised.
There was no promise before the flood?
No. There were no Jews before the flood.
But so. It's interesting because the destruction of the temple, uh-huh, when Christianity comes about, is because, you know, they claim
that's exactly
that God
right.
gave up on them.
That's exactly right. That's exactly
and
right.
Here we know.
Christians, all you have to do is point this out and say, sorry, folks, we're in for the long term. This is a permanent commitment. Now, would God feel like breaking it? I guess maybe so, because it's like, wow, you know, if I didn't have this promise, I think I would. But lama, to what end? You're going to start over? Who are you starting over with? So as they say, like, about capitalism and democracy, it's a terrible system. It's just better than any other one that's out there. So it's like, the Jewish people, are we perfect? No. Women aren't perfect. Men aren't perfect. But we are God's last great hope. We are God's hope. God is counting on us. And so that's right. But that's why the Christians, the Brit Chadash, that's what the New Testament means. It means the new covenant. The covenant with the Jewish people is now off because of their poor behavior. God dumped them, and now we have a new covenant. That is the basis of Christianity, regardless of what other people would like to tell you it is. That's the definition of Christianity. So in their picture, maybe we have like a nice little sidebar thing of like, you know, nice people, whatever. I don't know how they fix it, but that's the fundamental theology, is it's a New Testament, which means a new covenant, a Brit Chadash, which is why we're not even supposed to say the word New Testament, because it implies that we accept at some level that the existing one has been nullified. It's like, it hasn't, and it can't be. So we're in. So just like a Jewish person is Jewish, you cannot undo your Judaism, you cannot undo the covenant either. So we're in, for thick or thin. So this is it, and this is conveyed in this very strange, that we're given the ultimate comfort and promise at the situation in the Torah, which is at its bleakest. It's like, oh, good to know. This would be almost like children. This happens with children oftentimes who are adopted. They try to do things, subconsciously even, to the parents to see if the parents are going to give them back. And they will push it until the parents may have to repeatedly reassure them, it doesn't matter what you do. You know, children who are naturally born into a family push the envelope too, because also see, like, how much do you love me? I think I shared with you before, when Benjamin was little, I said, I love you, I love you, I love you. Would you still love me if I killed Audrey? Okay, so he asked that question. Yeah, and I said, I would turn you in, but I'd come and visit you every day. So it's like, I would love him forever. Someone who doesn't know if their position is like, why did you bring me into your family to begin with, is not ever, may never really feel totally secure, and is going to for sure do things to push the envelope to see how far does the love go. I don't think the Jewish people intentionally pushed the envelope with the golden calf, like, let's see how far God's love goes. But it ended up doing that, and we have this beautiful demonstration and articulation by Moshe and by God. It's like, we are in this forever. So that should comfort us as we go through the trials and tribulations of our life as the Jewish people, and we will get to where we are meant to go, one way or another. Hopefully we get there sooner rather than later, and it'd be nice to get there in good shape rather than battered. Vera.
I don't know where I heard this. I don't know if it's a midrash or what. But if it's for the sake of the Jewish people, doesn't, for their benefit, doesn't Hashem want you to argue with him?
Say that again.
So if it's for the benefit of the Jewish people, doesn't Hashem want you to argue with him?
Yes, absolutely. We're absolutely allowed. So Rabbi Levi of Berdichev was always arguing on behalf of the Jewish people with God. God, look at your beautiful people. You know, they're so amazing. And don't do this to them. They're so amazing. So yes, we are supposed to be the Jewish people's advocates always, which is why it's a specific form of Lashon Hara, of Rechilut, to say negative things about the Jewish people. We are supposed to be the Jewish people's advocates. That's our job. We're supposed to be like Moshe. We advocate for the Jewish people, and even in their time of sin and wrongdoing, we are, the Jewish people. They're a stiff-necked people, and you better believe that's going to be a good thing, because they're not going to roll over so easy. So they may be stiff for you, but they're going to be stiff for them also. So it's a good thing. So yes, advocate. Vera, with that, it was one of, since I know you're leaving, just tell the class, Vera's leaving for the land of Israel for until July, so we'll miss you, and we'll see you in May. And so.
What? Have a good trip. Where will you be?
In their home.
We have a home in Jerusalem.
How nice.